You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education podcast. I am your host, Sarah Custer, and in this episode, we're featuring an interview with Dr. Nicholas Dirks, a higher education leader, an historian, and the current president and CEO of the New York Academy of Sciences. Previously, he was chancellor at the University of Berkeley from 2012 to 2017, and over his career, he's worked at Columbia, the University of Michigan, and Caltech. In this interview, we discuss why true interdisciplinarity might be harder to achieve than some might think, how to communicate the public good of science to various audiences, decolonization, and if science should be leveraged in geopolitics. Enjoy. Dr. Dirks, great to have you on the Times Higher Education podcast. Thank you so much for joining us today. I wanted to start with a piece that you wrote for Times Higher Education back in August of 2021. And the premise of that piece was a commentary on C.P. Snow's Two Cultures, talking about this unfortunate gap between the sciences and the humanities. And it echoed a lot of what we hear around interdisciplinarity. And I know that your own academic career has been quite multidisciplinary, interdisciplinary. However, there are some criticisms of interdisciplinarity that it's not really happening right now in academia, that it's kind of a chemist will pair up with a biologist. Is that true for you? And if it is, how do you think interdisciplinarity could be done correctly?
Yeah, well, like you, I've been hearing about the two cultures as long as I've known anything about the university. So obviously C.P. Snow was good at coming up with a slogan that captured something real. When he did his lectures and published them in 1959, he was concerned that science was getting short shrift vis-a-vis the humanities. And of course, looked at from the present day, it feels a little bit the opposite, and often seems to be the case that the sciences get all the funding and the humanities, of course, are struggling. But the basic thrust of his argument, which was that the two sides of the university, the two quads, however they're actually located architecturally across campuses, are unhappily quite separate from each other. And my argument, and the reason I wrote this, so many years after he gave his Reed lectures, was that it's still the case, and we're still talking a lot about interdisciplinarity, but we're not actually doing nearly enough of it. And there are a lot of reasons for it. One, of course, is that you still find that people are trained, they're hired, they're evaluated and promoted. And ultimately, their work is done within disciplinary units and according to disciplinary protocols. There are other affiliated kinds of processes, protocols, and the like that I think further exacerbate that. But the truth is that, the more we talk about interdisciplinarity in some sense, the more we are located in our disciplines. We have, over the course of my entire career in the university, built institutes, centers, programs, initiatives that were all meant to be interdisciplinary. And they often are, and they bring together people from different parts of the university. They come together for workshops, they come together for grants sometimes, and they've certainly had an impact. But the truth is that, the department still reigns supreme, at least in most universities. And the universities that I know that have tried to create different incentive structures have typically buckled under the weight of the gravitational sort of pull of the department and of disciplines and the like. Mm. Now, your example that, we are, in fact, interdisciplinary when it comes to adjacent disciplines. I think that's become more and more true. Certainly, you have a lot of physicists, for example, working in biology, and that's been very, very good for biology. Biology obviously is a hot field. There are many, in some ways, many more things for physicists to do unless they have access to a super collider somewhere, and that often requires now flying to Switzerland. But do you really have the kinds of interdisciplinary collaborations that C.P. Snow called for, and that I reiterated in my piece, not so much. And and I think one of the things that I keep encountering are good new reasons why we really do have to rethink what we mean by interdisciplinarity, at the same time that we create far more successful mechanisms to promote not just interdisciplinary research, but interdisciplinary thought, interdisciplinary education, interdisciplinarity in a much more fundamental sense.
Tell me a bit more about those structures, because if everything is built around disciplines and different labs and centers that are set up, and you said it all, it will happen, but it kind of crumbles under the weight of the actual institution that might be set up. So what are we talking about here? Are we talking about kind of dismantling the structure of academia, or how are we going to do this?
Well, I wasn't quite suggesting the dismantling of the structures of academia, but I do think that, and I've worked throughout my career, as you mentioned, trying to at least chip away at the departmental edifice. I mean, one of the things that I've written about in other contexts is that I was educated in an area studies context. And area studies was inherently interdisciplinary, and it was inherently interdisciplinary in the United States anyway, because it grew up in World War II through things like the research and analysis branch of the Office of Strategic Services, where there were strategic reasons why economists and political scientists and anthropologists and literary scholars had to actually work together to formulate some kind of general account of different parts of the world that might be needed. Of course, it's not clear that this actually guided in any fundamental sense foreign policy or military conduct or whatever. But there were, in the case of U.S. history, extraordinary academics who actually were part of that World War II effort, many of whom went on to found some of the major centers of various studies in the United States. And they took with them that interdisciplinary background. And yet, area studies was always, in some sense, on the margins. And so in order, if you were an academic like me, to have a really successful career, you did area studies. That's where you went for kind of regional expertise, and you did, bask in the knowledge of different disciplinary perspectives. But ultimately, you got your job offers, and you got your, academic success through the particular discipline. Now, I had two, history and anthropology, but they're adjacent, chemistry and biology. So, on the one side, I fell into administration because I created a joint interdepartmental PhD program in anthropology and history at the University of Michigan. That's great. And it's still a great program. And in fact, I'm very proud of it. But, anthropology and history were, for years before I worked on that program, working closely together. So now the real challenge for us is, how do we really make sure that, for example, in thinking about the next frontier of GPT, natural language programming, artificial intelligence, we really do bring together philosophers and sociologists and also scientists across other fields, as well as computer scientists and computer engineers, to think through what the effects, what the implications, what the major issues are. And increasingly, whether you're talking about technology, whether you're talking about advances in biomedical research, whether you're talking about climate change, there's going to be, I think, a growing demand for genuine interdisciplinary perspective. And as such, universities have to keep up, I think.
It is often something when people talk about it, the way they talk about it is, we are doing interdisciplinarity to answer the global challenges that society faces. And this kind of leads into another topic that you've been writing about quite a bit, which is the public good that science serves. And I wonder if there's something there in terms of interdisciplinarity, and also kind of how universities are speaking about themselves, or science academies are speaking about themselves to the public, and kind of who they're making that argument to and how they're making that argument.
Yeah, when I went from Columbia to Berkeley, I went from a private to a public institution, and of course began to speak a great deal about the public good and about the importance of public higher education in the United States. And I believe in that. And I think, you know, one of the great tragedies of the public commons, in a sense, over the last 20, 30, 40 years has been the defunding of public higher education in the U.S. You know, it is extraordinary that a university like Berkeley was built up as a public university, a place that could compete with MIT, Harvard, Stanford, et cetera, on the one side, and on the other, have as many Pell Grant students as the entire Ivy League combined. So, and that's a measure of socioeconomic background and a pretty good index for a real commitment to at least socioeconomic diversity when it comes to university admissions. So, you know, this is an extraordinary accomplishment, and yet, you know, year after year after year, states cut back on their public funding. And you just see the kind of stress that public universities are under. And I experienced that during my time at Berkeley quite dramatically, because we just had major budget deficits in the face of a unwillingness or general disinterest, not in not continuing to really take seriously and fund at the levels required universities across the University of California system. So in that context, of course, I began to think, you know, how do you make an argument about the public good that is going to be compelling? And who do you have to make it to? Do you have to make it to the public? Do you have to make it to politicians? Do you have to make it to the state legislature? You know, if you're talking to the public, you're telling stories and you're giving examples. And we did that, and we tried as hard as we could to make a compelling case to you know, to different kinds of publics for the importance of the University of California. But you know, at the same time, because of defunding, tuition goes up, cost of living goes up around universities. Universities in California tend to be in very lovely locations that have very high housing costs, etc. And so people look at, you know, both how hard it is to get into these universities and how much it costs, and they begin to think, well, clearly this is not about public good, this is about private benefit, and that's the, so it became a kind of vicious circle almost. Now, that being said, you know, governments are susceptible, at least sometimes, to data, and there is, and you at THE have accumulated a great deal of this. There's a great deal of data that shows that you know, there are general economic benefits to having a university in your region. There are benefits, you know, large beyond the region and at the level of the nation in terms of the importance of scientific research, in terms of the creation of a broadly educated population that is educated across many different kinds of fields. And, you know, we see correlations all the time between levels of education and levels of political sophistication, in fact, even levels of political participation. You know, this is a special kind of problem in the U.S. because of the division between public and private universities. In the U.K., where obviously every university is at least administered by the public, even though there are colleges and entities within universities that have private funding. You know, this has become, of course, a major issue around cost as well. So it's a similar kind of situation. But again, as is, I think, true in any political context today, wherever you are, making the case for the public good is really hard. It has to do in part, too, with the kind of erosion of trust and even, I think, ultimately of legitimacy with respect to many public institutions. And so public universities become caught in that kind of vortex as well.
What you were just describing there was kind of talking about how universities are kind of fighting the battle on all fronts. They're having to prove their worth to potential students and their families, but then also doing it to the politicians and the governments who will ultimately decide if they what sort of public funding that they get. I wonder if universities are doing this better on one front or the other, in your opinion.
Yeah, good question. You know, I think, and this is one of the things I realized when I moved from the East Coast to the West Coast, I think there is a kind of residual sense in places across the Midwest and the western part of the United States that that public universities have been really important. Again, I think one begins to lose out when the flagship universities, the you know, the Michigans and Wisconsins and Texas's and you know, Berkeley's and UCLA's become so difficult to get into that they no longer feel like they're actually public. But it's certainly the case that you know, that we sort of see in every aspect of our lives, whether economic or political, social or cultural, that, you know, this kind of growing skepticism around the university, I think, has led to just real difficulty when it comes to making the kind of case that needs to be made, getting the support that you need, and ultimately doing more than just appealing to students who want to have the name brand. Now, those flagship institutions are still getting plenty of applications. In fact, this last year, again, there's been an increase in applications to flagships. But, you know, at the same time that that's happening, because, of course, the name brand continues to, as it were, get even more valuable, you find, you know, the next tier down in terms of public universities and private universities and colleges, for that matter, as well, beginning to really struggle to get the enrollments that they need. So you have, you know, more and more applications to UCLA and fewer applications to the Cal States and the local community colleges, which, of course, in terms of California, were fundamentally integrated into the whole system of public higher education through the master plan back of back in 1960. So it is a time when some people recognize the importance of education, higher education, more than ever, but in which the broader context is not nearly as rosy, and there's just an increasing amount of not just skepticism, but sometimes outright you know, distrust of what's going on, and that's a very hard thing to work against.
There's also an element of employment here. When you speak to students, especially undergraduates, they will say, I just want to get a job. I'm just doing this because I think that I can get a better job out of this. But then when they go, perhaps the employability element of their course is not there as much as they would like it to be. If you're a working parent, which often more and more the traditional student doesn't really exist, so it is often people who are going back to finish their credits or studying part-time. It seems like universities, and I mean universities specifically, not necessarily the colleges, really aren't helping themselves out by sticking to this quite rigid four-year degree structure. Again, going back to dismantling academia, does there need to be a little bit of that if we really want to win the case of winning over public opinion more than just telling wonderful stories and berating people with data and graduation rates and economic contributions? Does there need to be a big change in the offer?
Well, I think there actually has to be. I resisted your question the first time, but now I'll fess up. And I've even just recently finished a book on this that's going to come out next year, where I make some, you know, from somebody like me, I think, somewhat radical recommendations about the future of the sector. But yeah, look, I mean, a lot of the things that we continue to take for granted in the university were effectively established in the late 19th century. And whether that's the structure of disciplines and the way they map onto departments and the way departments actually organize academic life across the university on the one hand, or whether it's, you know, in the U.S. anyway, you know, 4 years of high school, 4 years of college, and then you go on for a master's degree if you want to get, you know, something a little more practical, or professional training across law and business and medicine, and of course the UK is somewhat different in that respect. But it's been no less locked into a fairly constant situation for many decades. So yeah, I mean, you know, students are right to look around and say, well, maybe, you know, I could go to college for 2 years and then I should be able to go off and you know, have certain skills that I can take and use and make some money with and possibly explore different kinds of careers. There's more and more talk about everything from, you know, micro-credentialing to, you know, to lifelong learning as, you know, two different kinds of positions on a big spectrum, which on the one hand should confer very specific skills fairly efficiently to students who need and want them, while on the other, through lifelong learning, making available the resources of the university across a lifetime to keep going back and getting reskilled or upskilled or differently skilled or whatever it might be. Are we really saying that, you know, that universities don't want to play that game, that they want to concede that to, you know, everything from new startups out of the Silicon Valley or for-profit institutions or what have you in the context of the U.S.? And there are lots of disincentives for changing anything in a university because everybody sort of figured out where they, you know, where they sit with respect to it. But now, with the academic job market as precarious as it is, particularly in the humanities and humanistic social sciences, with the needs for very, very intense big science kinds of research in many of the science and engineering fields. But again, with, you know, very different implications for education, with you know, with a growing recognition that, you know, certain kinds of skills don't require you know, sitting down and taking a full 4-year course, you know, from the 101 general distribution courses to the major, is indeed a sign that you know, there's the need to really begin to change things. There are a few universities in the U.S. that have, I think, been you know, very forward-looking in terms of devising new structures.
Any examples? Who are you thinking of when
you
say
know,
that?
Arizona State University's created, you know, very different kinds of colleges and holding entities for different kinds of departments. They've also, of course, you know, have a whole set of different kinds of educational opportunities, from major online offerings on the one side to small boutique, but nevertheless very affordable honors college on the other. You have Northeastern University that has built the internship work component of college life into their actual degree and not seen it as simply a sideshow. You have, in even the case of a small college close to where I am right now in New York, Bard College in upstate New York, which has invested in early college programs for sort of late high school, and thought differently about the way in which students might be able to enter into college level work. Again, those are three, I think, powerful but still pretty isolated examples of how things might begin to change.
I want to ask my next question, mostly because you're the head of a science academy. How can a stronger argument be made about the value of a humanities degree to employers and politicians? It's something that often gets pilloried in public discussions about, oh, the English language or the English major that is just going to make you destitute and poor after you graduate. And I'm saying this as an English major myself.
Yeah, well, you know, and in the interest of full disclosure, my son is an English major.
It works out for us. It does work out for us.
Yeah, no, totally. Well, you know, look, I, you know, again, my background in history and anthropology is not that much more, you know, what shall I say, connected to the real world, perhaps, than or at least as the real world is construed than English, but. You know, on the one hand, what I was just saying about the 4-year degree, you know, you have to accept that, you know, one of the reasons that we become so committed to it is because it does allow offering something that we call the liberal arts, and that if it doesn't lead to a particular major in the humanities or the humanistic social sciences, it certainly gives you some exposure and it gives you some education in fields that have a humanistic dimension. But, you know, again, I think, you know, it's important for us to think anew about how we do that. And in fact, it's, I think, necessary. And it's necessary also to answer the question you just posed me. What is the value of the humanities today? You know, I lead a science academy that has happened to have had a strong relationship to anthropology over its history. So I'm not an entire, you know, interloper, but but I brought to the academy a sense that really there's no scientific issue or challenge right now that doesn't require some input, not just from the humanities, but from the social sciences on the one side and from the arts on the other. And I make that case almost every day in my work at the academy. And in fact, it's a case that scientists not only accept, they embrace.
So they recognize it and they agree with you when you make that point.
Yeah, up to a point. I mean, you know, they also are aware of the huge demands for specialized work that go into, you know, getting a PhD in biochemistry or structural biology or physics, et cetera. But on the other hand, I was just listening to an interview with some neuroscientists over the weekend, and, you know, they were talking as much about questions that come straight out of the history of philosophy as they were about brain images and brain scanning. And there's a whole school within neuroscience, of course, that, you know, goes back to Descartes and you know, thinks about the mind-body problem as the fundamental question of neuroscience. By the same token, last week, you know, in reading my regular inbox of materials about ChatGPT, you know, there's not a single question that doesn't deal with issues around what it is to be human. How do we think about intelligence? What is the relationship between intelligence and sentience and consciousness and so on? And these are all questions that, you know, are out there in the public sphere right now in a very powerful way. At the same time, of course, that, you know, to get some level and degree of sophistication with respect to them requires taking some courses in the humanities. So in an odd way, even as the, you know, as the English major has become the butt of many jokes, the kinds of things that English majors routinely think about have become more and more important. You know, what does it mean to be a human? What does it mean to actually try to understand another human? Beyond, you know, thinking about machines in relationship to Turing tests, you know, what and how do we operate in a world in which, you know, so many of these kinds of fundamental questions that we've just sort of assumed were fixed are now, you know, sort of open. The borderline between human and machine, between the brain and some set of notions about what life is. These are all being questioned every day. Now, there's also, you know, very, very I think urgent questions around, say, ethics. I was talking to John Tisoulis, who runs a new institute for AI and ethics at Oxford, just in fact last week, and hearing about the work that that he's been doing there. And again, the kind of ways in which philosophy is undergoing a kind of efflorescence around issues that have been raised by AI, I think is another reminder that the humanities are pretty fundamental to what universities do, and what they have to be able to expose students to through the education we offer.
In the past decade or so, there's been an energized movement to decolonize various aspects of higher education. And as a scholar of South Asia and a former resident of India, I'm keen to hear your thoughts about what you think about this in terms of higher education in the Western world. Do you think it's making a difference? Do you think it's a worthwhile pursuit?
Well, I certainly do. You know, I've been involved in thinking about not just India and South Asia for many years, and indeed spent some time living there when I was younger. But I was also doing a lot of work that was roughly speaking grouped under the rubric of post-colonial studies. And as such, writing post-colonial history, writing post-colonial anthropology, I spent a lot of time thinking about what the problems, not just of colonialism as an historical set of events had been, but about the continuing residue of colonialism in both the places that had been colonized, of course also the places that had colonized, but also in the ways that academia approached the study of those places. So I spent a lot of time effectively trying to, you know, it didn't use the language at the time, decolonize the study of South Asia when it came to, you know, institutes and centers of South Asia and universities at Michigan, Columbia, even before going to Berkeley. So this is something I feel that is a continuation in many respects of work mm-hmm. that I had committed myself to be engaged in very seriously for years. That being said, I think there are a few caveats I would raise. For example, you know, one of the kinds of things that I've written about in the past has to do with the way in which ideas about culture, even ideas about civilization, but let's just take the anthropological idea of culture itself, had been formulated very much in relationship to an imperial history in which effectively some of the most some of the earliest and most most significant enunciations of cultural difference came from basically using cultural associations to justify colonial rule, whether through the kind of, you know, civilizing mission, in the case of India and Great Britain, for example, the huge amount of attention that was that's been paid to a variety of different issues about the treatment of women, sati, the ritual immolation of widows, etc. And there was a huge amount of use of sati as a kind of justification for British rule. That is to say, you know, look what they do in India. We've come, we've outlawed sati, and therefore, you know, you can see that that British rule has a moral justification. Now I say that because what in fact, what's less dramatic, but nevertheless, in some respects, even more important, is that, you know, a lot of the writings about caste, about gender, about sexuality, about a whole variety of things that we group under the different kinds, you know, that we talk about as cultural, effectively got set in that kind of colonial context, mm-hmm. And so, you know, so there are ways in which the legacy of colonialism is much broader, but also much more difficult to isolate and delineate than I think sometimes the current decolonizing rhetoric is open to. And I mean by that that it's much more difficult to decolonize everything about a long, deep historical relationship, which, you know, is going to survive whether or not one, you know, topples the statue of Cecil Rhodes at Oxford or mm-hmm. whatever else one might want to do. And I'm not arguing against that, but I am suggesting that, you know, there were some insights that I think we had in post-colonial studies that that might be useful for thinking about how complex these issues are, and of course the complexity is one that continues to circulate around a lot of the different ideas we have about culture, about relativism, about difference, and about representation. Well, and for that matter, identity. So these are, you know, these are things that again are all, I know, you know, fundamental to some of the efforts to decolonize, but as someone who has thought about the complexity of these issues over time, I'm just reluctant to see any effort to, you know, to make things better, which I believe is critical, take place without, you know, without accepting that, you know, that complexity is going to continue despite our best efforts. And as such, we need, I think, to build into our fundamental epistemologies around colonialism a rather more capacious set of frameworks. And I'll just give one other example, which is to say that, you know, many of the current issues that take place in a place like India you know, even the you know, the recent kerfuffle around Rahul Gandhi and
the opposition leader that that has since been kicked out of the government.
Well, he's been accused of defamation, and as a result of that, and with the stipulation of a 2-year sentence, which is obviously being appealed, he would be ineligible to, you know, to run for parliament. So it would have the effect of kicking him out of the political formal political process. That's a colonial law, and that's being used. And there are a lot of colonial laws that are used by post-colonial regimes, which you know, again, are not going anywhere anytime soon. So it's I also mean to say, there just you know, history has a way of embedding itself into the sinews of the present in ways that make it very difficult to cut it all away.
Whenever Russia invaded Ukraine, the world kind of shut off to Russia and Russian scientists. I'm keen to hear your response to that, and especially in light of the U.S. and Australia's response to Chinese scientists working in their countries. It seems like science is very much even more so getting caught up in the geopolitics of things. Is that right? Is that helpful?
Yeah, this is such an interesting, strange moment in our history. But for me in particular, because, again, I've spent my entire career trying to create better modes of collaboration and exchange between and among, you know, academics working in different parts of the world. I did that when I was at Berkeley, opened up a joint research institute in Shenzhen with Tsinghua University, and actually set up a joint climate institute between Berkeley and Tsinghua as well. And you know, I'm proud of those achievements, and I think that the open exchange of research between and among scholars in the U.S. and China has been really, really important for a variety of different reasons. First, the great scientists in China, and we're not going to keep advancing in the ways that we need to do if we just say we're going to not, you know, because there's security risks attached to every lab or every scientist in China. We're not going to have anything to do with them. That would be very counterproductive for science, but it would also, I think, be counterproductive for you know, for a world in which it's often the case that it's the scientists and the academics who actually have ways of talking across national borders that governments you know, periodically are sorely in need of. I believe that universities have actually been, in some ways, the most successful ambassadors of international outreach of any institutions, including our consulates and our embassies. I'm using that term quite deliberately because the amount of international understanding that has been achieved by the circulation of students and scholars across across China, Australia, the UK, the US. It's nothing short of remarkable. And because of current geopolitical tensions, you know, there's this idea you can freeze this all in place. And that because, you know, because, for example, the Chinese are doing such important work in AI, but also are developing state-sponsored forms of, you know, of facial recognition that are being used in less than defensible ways, at least as we look at it, we shouldn't have anything at all to do with them. Well, you know, first of all, we have issues of privacy in all of our own national settings. And you know, there are compelling reasons, in fact, to think cross-nationally about issues of data privacy, about the use of facial voice recognition, about different kinds of things, which isn't to say, I'm not a utopian in the sense that I will say that, you know, just talking about these things is going to resolve them. But not talking about them is certainly not going to resolve them, and it's also going to put our science back. You know, the engine of science is going to keep moving. We know that there are always, you know, complicated reasons that propel and end up providing great amounts of funding and support for scientific research, you know, the entire set of discoveries around quantum mechanics that, you know, took place in the 1920s was propelled largely by the recognition that physics was important to the conduct of World War I, and of course soon became directed to the creation of the atom bomb. So it's not a rosy story in the past, and it's not necessarily going to be a rosy story today. But I think we have to recognize that science is an international business, and that it has wonderful effects on things outside of science by virtue of allowing people to talk, and that's probably the best we can hope for at this point as academic practitioners and academic institutions, that we keep certain lines of communication open.
And would that be the case? You've spoken a lot about China, but I'm curious to know if you would apply the same approach to Ukraine and Russia. Was that right? I mean, I know that there are economic sanctions in place here and there are governments involved in that, but there was a pretty strong rebuke from the international academic community against their Russian colleagues pretty soon after that happened to just cut all ties. Was that right?
You did notice that I was talking about China, and that's because I was actively engaged in that. But when I heard somebody come out, and there was a congressman from California who came out and wanted to have a ban on any collaboration with any a Russian student or a scholar, you know, right after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and I was very much against that. And you know, it's not that there aren't, again, state-sponsored, scientific labs that are doing things that are deeply problematic and certainly allied with the Russian war effort. But my argument would apply to Russia as well. And I am, you know, I'm deeply disturbed that, you know, some of the kinds of collaborations that were ongoing just were stopped. MIT had a campus that it was helping to set up in Russia. Bard had a campus in, I think, in St. Petersburg. You know, these are all things that have stopped, and you can understand why they might be halted. But my hope is that the circuitry isn't completely disassembled so that we can start those things up again. But at the level of personal interactions, and also we just need to recognize that inasmuch as there are people in Russian civil society who are quite possibly among the most important critics of certain aspects of Russian foreign policy, and as much as, you know, we in the U.S. and the U.K. have seen scientific communities play active roles in protest and dissent as well, you know, we need to keep those lines of communication open.
You have a long career within higher education, working at several different universities. You're now leading a science academy, which is adjacent, but not totally within the confines and the structures with all the different pressures and politics of a university. What's different? What's different in the leadership of an academy versus a university?
Well, it's very different. To begin with, an academy has no faculty. It has no students. And it has no alumni, so that's about as different as you can get.
This is like a semi-retirement for you, then.
You know, it's interesting that, you know, a lot of these academies, including the one I'm leading now, the New York Academy of Sciences, were established, you know, when the very first universities were being established, certainly in the U.S. as well. The New York Academy goes back to 1817. And it actually helped play a role in the formation of NYU in the New York context. Columbia had been around before, but from its origins, the academy was actually a very interesting kind of adjunct to universities. It brought researchers out of the university to talk to people in the general public. There were, you know, discussions that took place at the academy about the work of Darwin and evolution. That weren't happening inside Columbia or NYU, but they happened at the academy because it was a more public-facing kind of organization. At the same time, that it brought together scientists from multiple institutions, not just from universities, but from industry, from big pharma, and from other kinds of, and you know, from government and non-governmental organizations as well. So I see leading the academy in some ways as a continuation of what I began to do when I became chancellor at Berkeley, which was increasingly to move from, you know, where I'd been almost all of my life inside the university to a relationship between the university and the world outside. So the academy becomes a place of, it's a place that convenes different kinds of people, but it convenes them with a strong base in academic knowledge, academic research, but with a strong commitment to addressing public issues and trying to bring the public in. And, you know, as we were talking about this before, but as good a job as some universities do and trying to create programs for public use, they actually don't do a very good job of it. And the academy is a place where you can actually do some of that and do it pretty effectively, because you can, again, you can get some of the best people from universities to come, but you're not being blocked, as it were, by internal structures within the university, and you're able to address the public in a way that, and, you know, just get the public to come through the door, or at least to click on the link to allow them to join the webinar, to be part of some of the discussions that we're hosting around these major issues having to do with, you know, science and society and the major challenges of the future. So I'm having a great time. I'm enjoying it, and I still interact a lot with students, and I still interact a lot with faculty, and we even have alumni of different programs and awards that we give. So I said that first thing in a bit in jest, but it is a little less complicated than Berkeley.
Dr. Dirks, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
I had a great time. Thank you, Sarah.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.